from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. No one likes hypocrisy. Say one thing, do another, and eyebrows go up. And yet we know degrees of hypocrisy are all over the place, maybe part of human nature. Walt Whitman said it plain. Do I contradict myself? Said Whitman. Very well, then, I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes. This hour On Point, a philosopher's take on our human capacity for hypocrisy, lines, limits, and just how deep it goes. Joining me today from Iowa City, Iowa, is Clancy Martin, philosopher, novelist, contributing editor for Harper's Magazine. His latest piece for the magazine's blog, On Hypocrisy, looks at humankind's long relationship with inconsistency, to say the least. You can find a link to his piece at our website, onpointradio.org. He's professor of philosophy and business ethics at the University of Missouri's Kansas City Block School of Management. Clancy Martin, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
You quote Molière at some length here, and it's quite wonderful, but maybe the rubber meets the road when he says in Tartuffe, he has his good guy say, or his naive guy maybe, the majority of men are strangely made, and their true natures are rarely displayed. You say this is quite true.
Yeah, the definitive study in Western literature that we have of hypocrisy is Molière's play Tartuffe, or The Hypocrite, it's called. Mm-hmm. And the character there, Cléante, is admitting that while Tartuffe, who is a straightforward hypocrite, he just simply professes one set of beliefs and then acts contrary to those beliefs and uses his profession of beliefs in order to manipulate all the people around him in order to get what he actually wants. Cléante, while he's intensely frustrated by everyone's inability to see the hypocrisy of Tartuffe, he finally kind of admits to himself, well, maybe hypocrisy is much more prevalent than I'd like to admit. And in fact, most people seem to share at least some measure of this quality of inconsistency.
So for them, that is the majority of men, and I have no doubt would include women here, but for them, the bounds of reason are too small. In their shabby souls, they love to lounge and sprawl. and there flourishes all kinds of hypocrisy. How do you define it, Clancy Martin? As a philosopher, just as a thinker, how do you define hypocrisy? We know when we see it, say one thing, do another. Is that a sufficient definition right there?
I think that's our opening definition, is saying one thing, professing one set of beliefs, and then doing another. And most often when we accuse people of hypocrisy, that's what we're accusing them of. So we think of, take easy examples, or politicians or televangelists, that sort of thing. They're saying you should live in a certain way, or you should do without your paycheck, and while I am living in a different way, or I am receiving a paycheck, for example. Then we might ask to refine our definition, why is it that a person would profess one set of beliefs and then act according to a different set of beliefs? And once we start thinking about that, we realize that what's going on is we have competing sets of beliefs. When you have two different sets of beliefs operating in a person's head, then you realize that the range of hypocrisy is much broader than what you might call the blatant hypocrite, that there are all sorts of degrees of hypocrisy, and that in fact, I think perhaps the most common kind of hypocrisy, and certainly as Nietzsche, the German philosopher, mm-hmm. Friedrich Nietzsche said, the most dangerous kind of hypocrisy is when we succeed in deceiving ourselves about what we believe before we go ahead and profess our beliefs. So we're we've turned ourselves into hypocrites while we're completely unaware of the fact.
Give us a sense of, in everyday life, that range of hypocrisies, all the way out to the penumbra here. If plainly saying one thing and doing another is the simple, straightforward demonstration of it, where do we get into the edges where you see it still vivid?
Sure. Here's a kind of easy example of hypocrisy that I worry about when I, in some of my work about how parents teach their children to lie. Let's say you've got your 5-year-old and you're pulling up to the kindergarten, and you're talking to your spouse or your partner on the phone, and you say, "Oh, I see Tom. I can't stand that guy." And then you hang up the phone, and Tom walks up to the car, and you roll down the car window, and you say, "Hey, Tom, great to see you, man. How's it going?"
And your child is watching all this.
Yeah, meanwhile, your child is doing this act of hypocrisy. Yeah, I see how the world works, exactly. And as a matter of fact, they are seeing how the world works, unfortunately. Or fortunately, it's complicated. But
what do you want them to learn? Roll down your window and say, "Hey, buddy, you scumbag. Maybe some hypocrisy is necessary to the lubrication of life."
Absolutely. First of all, I think we should recognize that some level of hypocrisy may be necessary in order for, as you put it, the lubrication of life. What really worries me there is not so much necessarily my hypocritical act when I am talking to Tom, as when I then turn to my child later in the day, catch them in some kind of minor lie, and say, "Now, son, it's always wrong to tell a lie." That kind of hypocrisy is the sort that I think we really ought to be worried about, because what it involves is this if we frankly acknowledge to ourselves that, "Oh, yes, we're hypocrites, but we are aware of our own hypocrisy, and so we're going to be careful in the ways in which we accuse others of hypocrisy, and we're going to be careful in the ways in which we sort of lay moral rules on other people or judge people by our own moral standards," then we might be all right. But the worrisome part is that we are ourselves hypocrites, and yet we are very, very free about accusing others of hypocrisy. And we are also we sort of wantonly disregard our own hypocrisy in all sorts of different and morally dangerous ways.
Now, that's interesting, because as I read you here in this wonderful piece, again, you can link to it, listeners, at our website, onpointradio.org. I read you as saying it may be inevitable that we are hypocrites in some degree. And your example there of pulling up to the school and not addressing someone that you don't respect, but nevertheless addressing them respectfully, and then later asking your child never to lie when the child has seen you lie, maybe that's just the baked-in tension that we actually need. I mean, what would you prefer? That we just either were, speaking a brutal, socially disruptive truth all the time, we accept that there is this kind of cheesy hypocrisy that's run through a lot of life. Would you say we better not do that either?
Well, I do think that you're absolutely correct that your implication that we need to, at some level, accept the fact that really we seem to be, our brains seem to be hardwired for hypocrisy. And what I mean by that is that as we look more and more carefully at the way beliefs form in the human brain, it looks as though they form in different areas of the brain that are designed for different kind of strategic jobs. So I have one set of beliefs, let's say, that are designed to deal with politeness. And then I have another set of beliefs which may or may not be compatible with my politeness set of beliefs that have to do with, I don't know, perhaps getting ahead in my career or perhaps even raising my children, let's say. And so once we recognize that, you're quite right. We should not say, well, hypocrisy is always wrong. We should say, yeah, we have to acknowledge that there's going to be some hypocrisy in all of us. I know that my own attention came to this question of hypocrisy when I was really angry about the intolerance of a particular political group that was being expressed, and I was just like, I could accept I could accept this political group if they weren't so intolerant. And then I realized, of course, that I was...
You had no tolerance for them.
I have zero tolerance for this bunch of folks, right? And then it occurred to me, okay, there's something obviously hypocritical going on here, and I need to be looking at my own belief structures. And that is, at least I think, the first step that we need to take, and it's a very old idea. I think it's what Socrates was recommending when he reflected on, that the famous saying "Nothis auton" that was at the Oracle of Delphi, "Know thyself," mm-hmm. Or we more commonly say, "The examined life is not worth living." I think that's what he was talking about, is that we have a moral obligation to engage in this epistemological, that is, like, knowledge-based act of constantly examining our own beliefs. Can they really be reconciled with one another? And especially examining those beliefs before we go pointing the finger at other people, before we go judging other people about their inconsistency in their beliefs, inconsistencies between what they profess and how they act.
One wonders if we live in an especially hypocritical age, or if it has always been thus. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the human capacity for hypocrisy. Stephen Colbert, a host of Comedy Central's The Colbert Report, next year to replace David Letterman late night, has become famous for ranting about the hypocrisy in public life. Last week, Colbert took on President Obama's Equal Pay Day, a day set aside to talk about equal pay for women.
Obama is a big fat hypocrite.
One recent study found the median salary for female staffers at the White House is 88 cents for every dollar a male staffer earns.
And I heard one woman in the White House doesn't get paid at all. In fact, she has been forced to grow her own food. It's sad.
That would, of course, be First Lady Michelle Obama with her White House vegetable garden. You never know who's Stephen Colbert is taking the ps out of right there, Clancy Martin. But there are plenty of opportunities. What do you think, that we live in a hyper-hypocritical age? Or is it a sort of steady state in human history, the degree, level of hypocrisy?
Well, I think it's a fascinating question. I do think that as often as we like to rail at the contemporary media and maybe also at the internet for kind of overexposure of an instant exposure of people's moral failings, I think in this instance it actually serves a very good purpose, which is that whether or not we ought to be so quick to judge hypocrisy in others, I don't think we should be. Nevertheless, at least hypocrisy is very, very quickly exposed these days, which, again, I think whether it is the person who's being exposed in their hypocritical actions and or beliefs or statements they are making, or it is in forcing us to think about ourselves, at least it gets us constantly thinking about hypocrisy. And hypocrisy is at its most morally dangerous, at its most damaging, when we ignore it, when we try to pretend that we ourselves are not hypocrites, or that there isn't hypocrisy going on all around us.
I need you to explain why you say don't be so quick to judge hypocrisy. I mean, you remind us Dante had hypocrites headed for the eighth circle, not the ninth circle, but the eighth circle of hell, along with counterfeiters, seducers, flatterers, sorcerers, and simonists. I don't even know what a simonist is. Maybe you can tell us. But, I mean, he had them pretty deep in hell. You're more forgiving.
Right. The tradition in terms of condemning hypocrisy starts back with Aristotle and his student Theophrastus, and this is in the Western tradition. Theophrastus went so far as to accuse Socrates of hypocrisy in his technique of using irony in order to try to teach his interlocutors how the mind works.
That's stern standard. If even irony is hypocrisy,
is a form of hypocrisy. And of course, you can see how, in a way, it is, because if you think that Socrates did know something and yet he was professing not to know anything, it looks at least inconsistent. And inconsistency is one of these, you know, telltale signs of hypocrisy. And then up in the Eichmann trials immediately following World War II, Hannah Arendt wrote her very famous book, The Banality of Evil. Mm-hmm. And there she said that there is nothing morally more blameworthy than the hypocrite. So we've got this, you know, 2,500-year-long tradition of condemning hypocrisy. Why would I say maybe we're being a little too hasty? The reason I think that we should temper our harsh judgment of hypocrisy at least a little bit is that the simple thing we were talking about earlier, that we ourselves have to be hypocrites, or at least I'm not sure that we have to be, that we tend so easily to be hypocrites in all kinds of our interactions in everyday life. And so before it's, you know, one of these things about who's going to cast the first stone, before we're so quick to say this political figure is a hypocrite or this religious leader is a hypocrite, maybe we ought to look at our own lives and try and sort out our own hypocrisies first.
There's the tension to recognize that it may be baked in the cake of human nature a little bit. On the other hand, if we fully accept it, where are we? Clancy Martin, stand by. Bob's calling from Lebanon, New Hampshire. Hi, Bob. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
I'm a retired philosopher myself.
Oh, good.
Except, of course, philosophers never retire.
Never retire, of course.
Yeah,
of course.
For better or worse.
I have two things to say. One is that I've thought for a long time that one of the positive things about hypocrisy is that it means that at least you have some standards.
Even if you abuse them.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Something to betray, okay?
Well, right, yeah, that's an interesting point.
Yeah.
Absolutely, I agree.
As I listened to you, I thought of Benjamin Franklin. Last evening, I was reading Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, and your guest there may well be aware of this. I had never read this before. That Franklin sets about to make himself to be a really virtuous person. And he's got here, I've got the book open to it, a whole list of virtues: temperance, silence, order, frugality, industry, and so on.
This is, as a young man, he sets out to achieve these.
Yeah, he's going to, in a very systematic way.
Yes.
Right. It's quite remarkable. But then later in the autobiography, he says that a Quaker acquaintance of him, and I resonate to that. I'm a Quaker myself.
Okay. Yep.
A Quaker said to him, you know, Ben Franklin, people think of you as rather prideful. And so Franklin says, all right, fair enough. So I'm going to add a 13th virtue to my list, and it will be humility. And when he lists that, he says, that means imitate Jesus and Socrates. But then the wonderful thing is that he talks about how pride is really hard to disguise. He says you can struggle with it, beat it down, mortify it as much as you want, but it still seeps out. And he says, even if I could conceive that I had completely overcome pride.
Yes.
I mean, if I had completely become humble, I would probably be proud of my humility.
Right. Yeah.
Yes.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not everyone up to his Quaker friend's standard there. At least Franklin's self-aware. Bob, I appreciate that. Clancy, what do you say?
Well, I think it's a great comment because it shows Benjamin Franklin, who I think is a reasonable sort of moral ideal to put forward, although, again, this does sound like a young man's list. But the fact that he was at least engaged in the process of self-examination, he recognized that self-examination was necessary for self-improvement. I think that's the right road for us to go down. And as opposed to Mark Twain, when he was commenting on hypocrisy, he said, nothing so needs reforming as other people's habits. And which just the, you know, of course he was poking fun at the hypocrisy we all engage in, that we're not particularly interested, most of us, unlike Benjamin Franklin, we're not particularly interested in reforming our own habits, but we love to reform other people's habits.
And of course, as soon as anybody else shows up, there were, you quote Emerson saying, every man alone is sincere at the entrance of a second person, hypocrisy begins. Right there, we begin communicating. Yeah. Monica's calling from North Tonawanda, New York. Monica, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to mention that I find myself being a hypocrite when I focus on others' behavior. It's almost as if I mimic them. It's really some form of insanity of mine. It's relative to what you were just discussing that when you forget yourself and just focus on others, well then surely you tend to pick up their habits. Is that crazy? Because I noticed that when I begin neglecting myself, then I start becoming very hypocritical.
But let me ask you, Monica, does that mean you're placing the blame for your shortcomings on others, that alone you're perfectly pure and wonderfully moral?
No, I'm saying if say my morals and my beliefs are I'm a recovering substance abuser.
Okay.
So I choose not to use. But when I allow myself out of my sheer boredom, being retired early from a disability, when I focus on other people's behaviors, then I can find myself finding it acceptable for me to go out and have a glass of wine or a drink on, when it does not make me feel good. And then I feel like a hypocrite because I tend to encourage others.
Sure.
So, if they're feeling down and they have a obvious drinking problem, and I try to encourage them. So it's just confusing to me, and I get really mad when I become a hypocrite.
Let's bring the philosopher in. What guidance here, Clancy?
Right. I also, it was Monica, is that correct?
Yes.
Like Monica, I am a recovering alcoholic, and I'm fascinated by the phenomenon of relapse, or what the philosopher Alfred Mealy calls backsliding. And I think I strongly believe that it's intimately related to the phenomenon of hypocrisy. And that is, they both are forms of what we call cognitive dissonance. And that is that our brain can entertain different sets of beliefs at the same time. And we sort of trying to sort through these different sets of beliefs, which are often incompatible, we get confused and we start acting in ways that are inconsistent with what we think that we believe, or inconsistent with what we say that we believe. And that's just within our own heads. Once we put other people into the picture, as you've been pointing out, Tom, it gets that much more confusing, because now we're dealing with their beliefs and perhaps trying to help them manage their beliefs. If, let's say, we're sponsoring someone who's in recovery, for example.
Mm-hmm.
My advice on this, I suppose, is that the job of a reflective person is to sort of be constantly examining our own beliefs and to see if we can slowly work in ways, and this is, I think, is a lifetime project, and I don't think it will ever be complete, but I think we can become gradually more successful at it, at slowly kind of knitting our beliefs together in a way such that the inconsistencies between our belief sets go down. I'm not saying they're going to disappear, and I don't think any of us are ever going to be completely honest, and I don't think it's a desirable thing to be completely honest. I don't think any of us are ever going to be completely sincere or completely authentic, and I don't think those as 100% goals are desirable. However, I do think in order to kind of maximize our ability to live lives that we're proud of, working in the direction of the goals of sincerity and authenticity and minimizing hypocrisy and inconsistency are desirable goals.
That would, at its best, you write, put us up there with the moral exemplars, the Buddha, Socrates, Mother Teresa, Martin Luther King Jr., Nelson Mandela, big shoes. Clancy, Monica, thanks for your call. Clancy, stand by in Iowa City. I want to go to maybe, I don't know what some people may think of these days as the heart of darkness of hypocrisy. Roxanne Roberts joins us from Washington. She's a feature writer, covers Washington's culture for the Washington Post, former co-author of the Daily Columnist, the Reliable Source, regular panelist on the NPR show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Roxanne Roberts, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Thank you so much. I hope the heart of darkness was not a direct slam at me, right?
No, but of course not. No matter what I thought, how could I say? But are you stewing? Is Washington a terrible stew? Eighth circle of Dante's hell, stew of hypocrisy?
Well, this is what we haven't discussed yet, and this is what I think is absolutely critical, is if we start from the thesis that we're all hypocrites on one level or not, then the question is, then what is the action? And this is where I'm going to disagree with Clancy, because I think judgment is absolutely critical in this respect.
If you judgment as in passing judgment.
As an absolutely passing judgment. I pass judgment on a daily basis, and this is why. I think that judgment depends on the degree in which others' hypocrisy impacts my life, your life, other people's lives. So if you have a lawmaker who is unfaithful to his spouse and undermines his marriage because of adultery, I would consider that private hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. If that same lawmaker supports, say, the Defense of Marriage Act and other legislation based on his belief on the sanctity of marriage and all the threats to that institution, and deprives other people from that, or say cuts food stamp benefits but accepts millions in tax reliefs for, let's say, his business, then I would strongly argue that hypocrisy impacts my life and that I should look at that severely, because I don't think that person has the right to act in that way, in act in a way that impacts my life negatively.
Is there
while
a culture,
professing to believe something else?
Is there a culture of calling that hypocrisy out in Washington today? I mean, Colbert on his show, he sort of one way or another does it almost every night. But is calling that out, passing judgment, passing it publicly, stating judgment on that kind of hypocrisy, the norm?
I think it is, and I think it should be, because there is, if we elect someone, we'll stick to elected officials for the moment.
Okay.
If we elect someone to represent us and their belief system is such where they're behaving in one way, but they're professing a different kind of belief, then I think their constituents have every right to understand those inconsistencies, pass judgment on those inconsistencies, and decide whether or not that's the person they want representing them. Now, I think another complicating factor in this is that I think sometimes hypocrites do not have the intent to deceive others. I think there's Tartuffe, which is very clear, but I think sometimes someone has a deeply held belief and they act in a contradictory manner of that, but that doesn't change the fact that they never intended to deceive.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the human capacity for hypocrisy and just how deep it goes. Lots of comment online here. Let's see. Lita says, when she runs into hypocrites, she says, I put out a hit on them. Then I go to church. Oh, Stephen says, I punish hypocrites, but I let myself off when I do it. Johnny says, how many times do you curse a driver for doing something stupid, then the next day find yourself doing the same thing? And right on down it goes. Vicky in Chagrin Falls, Ohio. Great location for a hypocrisy call. Vicky, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My comment is, I feel our politicians in the last 20 years have been pushed into being
hypocritical. Mm-hmm.
Hypocritical, thank you. Simply because all of a sudden they were called flip-floppers. In other words, if you have the ability to see both sides of an issue, mm-hmm, and you can understand both sides and say what you think in the first place, and then you change your mind, you're considered a hypocrite simply because you can see both sides of a story because they jump on it so fast.
Yeah, this is interesting. Let us pick it up, Vicki. This is interesting. What about it? Roxanne, we'll bring it first to you, then to philosopher Clancy Martin here. But we have seen this in Washington. If you look at two sides of an issue and articulate seeing both sides, there are many hard bar ideologues on both sides who will call you hypocrite right away these days. So maybe people have been pushed into someone's definition of hypocrisy, Roxanne.
That's such a small part of hypocrisy that I think it's one of the least worrisome. But I do think it goes back to the question of intent to deceive. If you honestly reconsider, and at the time you took an action based on a belief that was a sincere belief, then I would not call that hypocrisy. And I think that it is a easy and cheap attack in the political game. And I certainly, John Kerry was deeply hurt by that when he ran for president. But I don't think that the kind of hypocrisy that is deeply worrisome has to do with a sincere change in a belief system. I think it has to do with an attempt to benefit from one position when your belief system is a different one.
I mean, Clancy, it's interesting here because you profess a fair amount of sympathy with the hypocrite, to a point. Roxanne describes a political system in which it almost becomes a tool for ongoing deception.
I think Roxanne and I are almost entirely in agreement. First of all, I do want to say that I think it is a great merit of the media today that hypocrisies tend to be so immediately exposed, not only because it forces the person who is being exposed as a hypocrite to reevaluate his or her own hypocrisy, but also because it keeps us hopefully thinking rather than always thinking about, yeah, that person's a hypocrite, that person's doing the wrong thing. Hopefully it causes us to reflect back on ourselves and ask ourselves, well, what about my own beliefs? But she's hitting on something that I really want us to pay attention to that's a crucial point, and that is this question of deception. There was a 2004 cover of The Economist during the height of the fervor over weapons of mass destruction during the second Gulf War with Bush and Blair arm in arm, and they were both smiling, and the caption read, "Sincere Deceivers." And the point they were making there is that both Tony Blair and George W. Bush, before deceiving all the rest of us about weapons of mass destruction, managed to self-deceive themselves through selective attention, through a process of paying only attention to those facts which confirmed what they already wanted to believe, into sincerity so that they could then sell this war with a clear conscience. And that is what many people who have worried about hypocrisy think is the most morally pernicious kind of hypocrisy. When we find instances of people who first self-deceive before deceiving others, there you have a kind of sincerity because there's a coherence, an apparent coherence between what the politician or whoever it happens to be believes. I think Bush genuinely believed there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and then what he goes on and professes
and
to everyone else that he believes.
That's more morally pernicious to you than a deliberate deception, a knowing deception?
To me, yes, that is more morally pernicious, and I'll tell you why. The reason is that it is much more difficult to expose, both for the person practicing it and for the rest of us around that person. If in these cases, like Roxanne is talking about, where you've got a person who's saying, listen, I think that we should not allow women to get abortions, and then it turns out that they've paid for the abortion of a lover, for example. Those are relatively easy to expose, and let's hope the media continues to do a good job of exposing those when they're in the public sphere when they are relevant to all of our political public lives. And I completely agree with Roxanne about that. But much more difficult to expose are the kinds of hypocrisies that involve these layers and layers of deception, and particularly self-deception.
Roxanne, put a yardstick up against those two in Washington now. Do you see more of this self-deceived hypocrisy or the deliberate manipulative hypocrisy?
I think the common denominator is the fact that ultimately they benefit the hypocrite.
Exactly.
I think it's much harder to say, using the example of the Iraq War, that President Bush deliberately set out to deceive, even though some people would make that claim. However, he certainly benefited by the choices he made in terms of what he examined. The real moral hero in that case would be a politician who discovered information that would undermine his political positions or popularity and go public with that. In all these cases, and there's a new documentary on Rumsfeld that's very interesting mm-hmm. for this reason, there is an entire process where the person either deliberately deceives or deceives themselves and then sounds sincere, but they always benefit. They're always justifying the choices they made. They're always making themselves the hero of their own book.
This is one of the things I want to emphasize that is most fascinating about this discussion is the telltale sign of self-deception and I think of hypocrisy if you're worried about self-examination is when you find yourself winding up believing what you already wanted to believe, when you believe what, as Roxanne aptly puts it, serves your own interests, that's when you should take a step back and say, wait a second now, should I examine this belief more closely? Did I arrive at this belief for good reasons or just because it was what I wanted to believe?
Here's kind of a classic moment from, this is March 27th. This is 2011, but this is Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday talking with Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the House back in the days when President Bill Clinton was looking at impeachment over the Monica Lewinsky scandal. And here's Gingrich pressed over the concern that his own marital infidelities had made his calls to impeach Bill Clinton in 1998 hypocritical.
You were leading the charge to push Bill Clinton from office for lying about an affair. And yes, he lied in a court proceeding, in a deposition, where he had sworn to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. But at the very same time that you were leading that charge, you were having an affair. Isn't that hypocrisy?
No. Look, obviously it's complex, and obviously I wasn't doing things to be proud of. On the other hand, what I said very clearly, and I knew this in part having gone through a divorce. I had been in depositions. I'd been in situations where you had to swear to tell the truth. I understood that in a federal court, in a case in front of a federal judge, to commit a felony, which is what he did. Perjury was a felony. And the question I raised was very simple. Should a president of the United States be above the law?
So Chris Wallace says, Roxanne, isn't that hypocrisy? And Newt Gingrich says, no, it's complex.
It is complex. Mm-hmm. You know, Newt might be technically correct when he says that his question about whether or not a president should lie under oath was really the issue. And I think you can, and Washington is a hotbed of parsing things down to technicalities.
Yes, yes.
So people can get off. But I do think that one of the larger issues here is that kind of rhetoric is what fuels a lot of anger. I think a lot about the Wall Street bailouts and the people who are making $40, $50 million a year who seem to be disdainful of assistance to anyone who's quite poor and perhaps down on their luck and not doing that well, as if their position is because of a moral failing. But the large wealthy institutions and their stewards are necessary to the survival of the country, and therefore they didn't get anything like a handout. They got what was necessary to keep things running.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of basically kind of sleazy, kind of sleazy rhetoric is what has fueled a lot of class war, resentment, a lot of anger and mistrust about government and some of the larger institutions, because they believe that there's a lot of hypocrisy when it comes to treating one class of people one way and other people a different way, that the standards are quite different and there's no such thing as a fair playing field.
And as Molière wrote in Tartuffe, and their piety, which gains them an accolade, is a tool to slay us with a sacred blade. Wall Street or anywhere else, you can wield that in self-interest, Clancy, is your point here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I do think that, I think it's Roxanne and everyone else who is sort of in fighting the noble fight of speaking truth to power, exposing lies when they are being told, exposing radical inconsistencies when they're being practiced by politicians and other powerful people in our society. Mm-hmm. I think all these people are certainly to be applauded. At the same time, I think we should be aware of the fact that a lot of our moral indignation, a lot of the moral indignation that we enjoy as a sort of populace, is very often misplaced insofar as we are unwilling to turn the same kind of microscope back upon ourselves and ask ourselves, well, wait a second, in my own life, am I engaging in just these kinds of behaviors that are also impacting people around me? Whether they're family and friends or professionals around me, et cetera. So I think what I take away from our discussion of political hypocrisy is that, okay, certainly we should expose the hypocrisy of politicians, but we should also take a good look at ourselves.
Let's go to Neil in Watertown, Massachusetts, if I may. Neil, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to read Shakespeare's Sonnet 138. It takes about 45 seconds.
All right.
Points to inevitable and mutually accepted hypocrisy. When my love swears that she is made of truth, I do believe her, though I know she lies, that she might think me some untutored youth, unlearned in the world's false subtleties, thus vainly thinking that she thinks me young, although she knows my days are past the best. Simply, I credit her false-speaking tongue. On both sides thus is simple truth suppressed. But wherefore says she not she is unjust? Wherefore say not I that I am old? Oh, love's best habit is in seeming trust, and age and love loves not to have years told. Therefore, I lie with her, and she with me, and in our faults by lies we flattered be.
Oh, Neil, thank you for that.
And in our faults by lies we flattered be. Yeah, my favorite part of that sonnet is when he says, love's best habit is in seeming trust.
Yes.
And it's a brilliant meditation on self-deception and how self-deception is necessary in the context of love and interpersonal relationships.
They're a kind of mutual back-scratching, but Roxanne, you make a distinction when it comes to the public arena.
I do, and I
exactly.
really think, you know, I think Clancy might be a nicer person than I am. He might be a more forgiving person. I tend to leave forgiveness to God, and I think that at least when it comes to the public sphere, it is absolutely necessary to keep a strong standard of judgment based on behavior and rhetoric, because I'm more likely to be damaged in significant ways by a public kind of hypocrisy than I am in a private. And or society, let me just say this, society is more likely to be damaged by public hypocrisy and individuals in the position of public trust than private. It may be disappointing if you are betrayed by a friend, but it might be life-changing if you are betrayed by a lawmaker who makes it impossible for you to function in a way that you would like to in your life.
It's simply maybe too easy to go with self-interest. Clancy Martin quotes Rilke saying, if you want to know the right thing to do, simply do what is most difficult. Not an easy hypocrite's path, Clancy.
That's right. I mean, one thing I like about the sort of larger drive of Roxanne's remarks is that we should be our sort of our epistemological hackles, let's say, our awareness of the situation should be heightened when we see ourselves or anyone else, a politician, always arguing in favor of what confirms their own interests, what suits their own good.
Yeah, the whiff of hypocrisy comes quickly there. Clancy Martin, this has really been fun. We're grateful to you for joining us from Iowa City today, professor of philosophy at the University of Missouri, Kansas City's Block School of Management. Clancy, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Tom. And nice to meet you, Roxanne.
Roxanne Roberts,
nice
Washington
to meet you,
Post. Thank you, Roxanne. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.